From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And House Speaker Paul Ryan today said he's still endorsing the Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, even though Trump said he's not ready to endorse Ryan, who faces a primary next week. But Ryan called Trump's comments on the Kahn family beyond the pale. Meanwhile, Trump's team insists the campaign is on track. Here's his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, speaking on Good Morning America today.
The support for Mr. Trump is there. The campaign messages are worked out. The themes of this campaign are settled.
But a number of prominent Republicans are distancing themselves from Trump. Matt Mikowiak is a GOP strategist who's been arguing in favor of getting Trump off the ballot. He joins us now from Austin. And Matt, I want to start with some tweets that you sent yesterday. The last one said, the GOP has a drunk driver at the wheel chugging vodka, and he's got other people's children in the car. He must be stopped. What is it that got you to that point with Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the outrageous things he's said and done for the last year probably should have brought all of us to this point. But the stakes in the primary were a lot lower than they are now. He's now the nominee. We're in the general election. We're 95 days or so from November 8th. And so the stakes couldn't be higher. For me, I found his comments to the Gold Star family totally unacceptable. When you add on top of that the fact that he's now doing intentional damage to our candidates as the GOP nominee by playing games in Paul Ryan's primary, by not endorsing John McCain, our previous nominee, by not supporting Kelly Ayotte, who's in the single most competitive U.S. Senate race in New Hampshire this year, our party has no responsibility to a candidate that's doing intentional damage to our candidates down ballot. And so, you know, what I tried to detail yesterday is an approach that might be able to convince him to drop out, because you really can't remove him from the ballot. There's some flexibility in the RNC rules, but it would take an extraordinary circumstance for the RNC, the 167 members of the Republican National Committee, to take that kind of step. At this point, I think the better approach is to convince him it's in his best interest to withdraw his name from the ballot.
But wouldn't it take an extraordinary circumstance to convince Donald Trump, who's just gone through this entire process and made it to this point, that it's in his interest to drop out of the race?
Yeah, look, I'm not sitting here saying this is a guaranteed outcome. I think it's worth pursuing, and I actually think there is a chance of doing it. Look, what Donald Trump doesn't want to be is he doesn't want to be a loser. You know, just today, you had three disastrous battleground state polls come out in Michigan, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania. He's down 15 points in New Hampshire, a state that he won, you know, in the primary. If you can convince him that he is on a glide path that is going to lead to a loss, he can go back to business, and his brand has doubled or tripled in value over the last year. All the people that have learned about his golf courses, his hotels, have come to like him. He has millions of fans now that are brand new. And so I think what's clear is he does not want to be embarrassed. And losing to the Clintons, perhaps in a historic fashion, would be embarrassing to him personally. And this is what I think is most important. It would be embarrassing to the children. And the way their father is acting right now, it's doing tremendous damage to them as well.
So let's just play this out, even though you admit that it's unlikely that he would decide to drop out. But let's play this out. Who becomes the nominee and how?
So the 167-member RNC could either call a new convention or, more likely, vote remotely, either, you know, by phone or by proxy or something like that. You know, look, we're in uncharted territory here, okay? I mean, I have to admit that up front. And time is of the essence. You know, North Carolina, for example, their ballot deadline to withdraw your name is August 5th, okay? That's tomorrow. Trump's campaign right now is they have a very narrow path to victory, where if they win all the Romney states, which includes North Carolina, they then have to win Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania. So in a way, starting tomorrow, it's almost too late. They can't afford to lose North Carolina. But with that, you know, you do have ballot deadlines the rest of the month. And so from my standpoint, it has to happen by August 26th. That's when Texas's ballot deadline occurs. Republican nominee cannot afford to lose Texas to the Democrat and still a chance to win. So I think we've got 5 to 7 days here. This is part of why I think this intervention is happening. With the RNC chairman, with Newt Gingrich, with Rudy Giuliani, you know, they're not going to try to get him to quit, but they're going to say, look, that's a realistic option. You know, they're going to talk about changing tone and hiring new people, but that's not the problem. The problem is Trump. At 70 years old, you do not change who you are. He has shown he has no self-control, a very limited vision for the future of the country. And the chances of him keeping this race competitive on the current trajectory are very, very, very low.
What do you say to people, though, who look at all this and say, the polls are wrong? Trump has clearly tapped into something around the country. He's got this base of support that's not your usual right and left, that he's found something and that, in fact, he will do much better than everybody's saying that he's going to do.
There's a couple problems with that. First of all, Trump's image is the worst of any candidate for president in my lifetime. He is upside down, viewed more negatively than positively by a large majority of the public. If he were not the nominee, we would be saying the same thing about Hillary Clinton. We've chosen probably the two least popular individuals in the country to run for president this year. Keep in mind, Mitt Romney got 60 million votes 4 years ago. That was the most votes that anyone has ever gotten in the history of the country, except Barack Obama 4 years ago. And Romney still lost by 5 million votes. So Trump has got to go out and get, you know, 65, 70, 75 million votes to win this election. He got 13 million in the primary. Where does he get that extra 60 million votes? That's a question that they can't answer, and his numbers make it impossible right now.
That's GOP strategist Matt Mikowiak, president of Potomac Strategy Group. Matt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And health officials in Miami-Dade County begin their aerial attack on the Zika virus today. Spraying insecticides from the air is the latest effort to contain the mosquito that's infected at least 15 people in the Miami area. Earlier this week, pregnant women were told by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to stay away from the neighborhood where the Zika virus has been found. And as Sammy Mack of Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami reports, the conversations between expectant mothers and their doctors are taking on a new urgency.
Late last fall, Dr. Christine Curry was at a faculty meeting with her colleagues when the conversation turned to new reports linking the Zika virus to a surge in microcephaly in infants in Brazil.
I think it's fair to say that most obstetricians had never heard of this virus a year ago.
Curry is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Miami Med School and a doctor at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. She has a background in virology, and so she volunteered to look into this troubling new virus.
I knew from the get-go that it may end up being nothing and just an interesting story out of Brazil, or it may end up being a reproductive game changer, which is, I think, where we're at right now.
Curry estimates her practice has now seen about half of the pregnant Floridians who have screened positive for Zika infection. All of those cases are related to travel outside the continental U.S. But now that local mosquitoes have likely spread the Zika virus to a one-square-mile zone in Miami's Midtown and Wynwood district, pregnant women and their doctors are on high alert. By some estimates, up to a third of babies born to women who contracted Zika while pregnant develop microcephaly or other developmental disorders. But there isn't much research on what happens later in childhood. When Curry finds a patient may have been exposed to Zika, she talks to her about getting a blood test to determine whether she's had the virus. Results take 1 to 3 weeks. While pregnant women tend to be prepared for the anxious waiting periods that come with all sorts of routine testing for birth defects during pregnancy, right now, nothing has quite the profile of Zika.
I have to admit, I got a mosquito bite this morning, and it's probably the first time I ever cried over a mosquito bite.
Sonia Knight is due with her second child in mid-October. Knight lives in a Miami suburb, but she spent time in Wynwood, including a dinner the night before pregnant women were told to avoid the area. Knight called her midwife, who's prescribing a screening test.
It would be nice if I could just have my baby already. How can I rush this?
If a test in a pregnant woman does come back positive for Zika, then providers like Christine Curry add another layer of counseling and monitoring to their prenatal care. Curry makes sure to do it in person.
As with any time you deliver bad news, they're really upset and they don't hear everything you have to say initially. So it's really helpful when they come with family, or you may say, listen, I'm going to write this down for you. I'm going to see you again next week and we're going to rehab this entire conversation when you've had a little bit of time to process things.
Next steps may include ultrasounds to hunt for brain abnormalities, and depending on which trimester she's in, an option to terminate the pregnancy. Microcephaly is just one of the symptoms of a baby harmed by Zika. It appears the virus is also associated with deformities of the hands and feet, trouble developing sucking and later swallowing reflexes, and vision and hearing loss.
It's a brand new area. We don't know very much about it.
Dr. Charles Bauer is a neonatologist and director of Early Steps in North Miami-Dade. His program is government-funded and provides resources like speech therapy and other interventions to babies and toddlers at risk of developmental delays. Bauer is part of a new team of doctors and therapists at the University of Miami and Jackson Memorial Hospital who are coordinating efforts to care specifically for babies with Zika-related birth defects. As soon as a baby with a known Zika exposure enters the nursery, Bauer and his colleagues will be able to start screening and develop a plan with the family.
We could be looking at lots of other things that wouldn't show up until a baby is older. Going to school, learning disabilities, things like that.
But programs like this take money, and he's concerned that Washington lawmakers haven't yet agreed on a funding bill for Zika.
They need to stop playing politics, because it's a big problem, and it's going to get bigger. It's escalating every day.
Against the backdrop of so much uncertainty, Bauer and other South Florida doctors are doing what they can to help expectant mothers and their babies. Again, Dr. Christine Curry.
I think I picked OBGYN because 95% of the time, I am there for the happiest day of someone's life. But there's a small fraction of what we do that's really hard.
Curry says she wants women with Zika to be prepared for a tough experience, but she doesn't want them to lose the excitement of having a baby. For Here and Now, I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
In the fall of 1969, the Rolling Stones hit the road for an American tour, their first in 3 years. The Stones tour ended on a chilly December night at the Altamont Speedway in Northern California. The free music festival quickly grew ugly. Peace and love, Woodstock West, it was not. The Hells Angels, hopped up on bad acid and whiskey, were in charge of security. Scores of people were beaten, and a young concertgoer was stabbed to death in front of the stage while the Stones played. To some, it was rock and roll's ugliest moment. Joel Selvin's new book uncovers new details in Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. Joel Selvin joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be here.
Joel, set the scene for us. The Stones in 69, were huge. They had a new guitarist in Mick Taylor. The band was really intrigued by the Summer of Love psychedelia of the San Francisco sound. It's almost as if Mick Jagger wanted his own sort of version of Woodstock on the West Coast. Is that correct?
I think so. I think the Stones originally scheduled that tour out of sort of a financial emergency. They were broke and they couldn't get the money that they were owed out of their manager. And when they arrived here, they discovered the rock scene was quite significantly different than the 3 years before when they last played in the United States. And I think they were quite surprised by how famous, how enormous the whole rock scene had come and what their position was. And over the course of the tour, as they began to discover this, they began to see a vision of a bigger, brighter future. And the last dates in New York were filmed for a movie that hadn't been planned until the day before. But they didn't have an end to the movie. They just had the New York. The free concert had been in the works. It was an idea that had been promoted to Keith Richards by the Grateful Dead manager, Rock Scully, and I think in a somewhat sort of whimsical fashion. But it had been taken seriously in the Stones camp, and Rock, he picked it up and ran with it. And at that point, I think that the vision of this free concert in this Woodstock-esque setting was just too seductive as an ending to this movie.
So the Stones were just beginning to understand the depth of their own fame and popularity. And you make clear that one of the Grateful Dead's managers, Rock Scully, was really behind the idea to let the Hells Angels provide security for the free concert. But the Stones went along with it. It proved to be a fatal mistake.
The Hells Angels were well known to the Grateful Dead. One of the Hells Angels, for instance, was the LSD distributor for Owsley, the manufacturer of all the Grateful Dead's LSD and their audio expert. The original plans called for the concert to be held in Golden Gate Park, which would put the San Francisco chapter of Hell's Angels squarely in charge. When it moved out of San Francisco after the Rolling Stones tried to get permits out of the mayor's office, Rock Scully never expected to do it that way. His plan was to have a Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane concert and bring the Stones in as a surprise special guest. But when it moved out of San Francisco, then there was no jurisdiction for the Hells Angels, and it was a free-for-all. Don't think that that kind of subtle politics of the Hells Angels that was totally lost on the Rolling Stones, who had no idea who the California Hells Angels were. They'd had a free concert in Hyde Park, and British Hells Angels had attended and been given some role backstage. But these guys had clean leather jackets. They drew their colors on with chalk, and they rode mopeds. They were not
the Hells the Angels, Angels, right? Angels. And the first thing that happens to Mick Jagger when he gets to the concert site and gets off the helicopter, somebody cold cocks him in the face.
They hit Mick. Somebody hit him.
Yeah, some kid just comes up and just says, you know, hate you, Mick Jagger, and punches him. The whole day was just filled with random acts of violence. It was just a terrible, bad happenstance from the dawn when the gates crashed and the crowd flooded in. Even the night before, which was some kind of like medieval bacchanal in the woods with, you know, thousands of stoned and drunk people wandering around in the dark, setting fires to barns and fences.
And the violence just escalates during the day, culminating in the Stones show. Set the stage here. Hell's Angels are starting to beat people with pool cues and brandishing weapons.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out in the book was the nature of the psychedelic drugs at that time. In 1967, the Summer of Love, the people who made LSD were missionaries. They were zealots, and the chemists took great lengths to make sure that the compounds were stable. 2 years later, the manufacturer just devolved, and there was a lot of really poisonous LSD out there. I talked to the doctors that ran the, you know, the bummer tent, the psychiatrists, and they were appalled at what they were seeing. And the Hells Angels were all on drugs, those drugs too. There are a few guys that were put in front of a stage, 300,000 people from a mile away pressing down on the stage was 4 feet high. And right during the Santana set, the opening set of the day, the pool cues came out and people in the audience started getting beaten.
And it's all on film in the famous documentary about the Stones, Gimme Shelter. The Stones are playing, and the Angels just keep beating people up, and both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards plead with the Angels to stop.
Who's fighting what for? Who's fighting and what for? Why are we fighting? Why are we fighting? We don't want to fight. Come on. Look, Cat, that guy there, if he doesn't stop it, man. Listen, either those cats call it, man, or we don't play.
There's a lot of blame to go around for Altamont, but you seem to put a lot of it in the book on Mick Jagger and his ego. You write, Jagger made the fatal error of believing his own hype. He bought into the myth of Woodstock and believed that he could do it better.
There's just so much innocence, and in the innocence, an arrogance. Nobody really knew what they were doing. They just assumed it could be done. And Jagger was dismissive of things that were brought up in planning sessions like sanitation and food and water. Oh, those are practical realities. We can deal with those later.
Right.
So I don't think they were really very conscious of this. I think they lived in a bubble and just felt they were the Rolling Stones, and of course this would just work out and be fine.
Well, you seem to imply, too, that you know they needed an ending for their movie, and boy, did they get it.
More than they planned on.
Yeah.
But the movie, of course, is embedded in all the story. They moved the concert at the last minute because of the movie and their unwillingness to negotiate any piece of the movie rights with the owners of Sears Point Raceway, where after the Golden Gate Park site had collapsed, they were removing this. And that place had parking for 100,000 cars and infrastructure. It had a site on the hill where the stage would be elevated above the crowd. It was much more suitable than some dumpy track in the middle of nowhere with no toilets and no water. And that's never part in the movie. The movie doesn't make it clear. There's scenes in the movie where they're negotiating with sheriffs and stuff, but it's not like made clear exactly what's going on. What's going on is the Stones are trying to save their money, and they don't care who they do business with as long as they keep 100% of the revenues from this movie.
You raised some questions in the book, too, of where were the police? They still had a responsibility here. The Hells Angels had control of the stage and the perimeter, and the police were largely absent until things got really out of control.
Oh, the police didn't show up until after there was a murder. There were no arrests made. They just sat there and watched it. The vehicular manslaughter case, which rarely gets mentioned, they had the suspect in custody, and he got away.
Joel, there's a popular idea that Altamont marked the end of 60s idealism. Is that accurate, or was this just a really dark day? What changed after Altamont?
I'm not sure what changed after Altamont. It certainly wasn't the end of the movement. It wasn't the end of idealism. It wasn't the end of even free concerts in the park. Hmm. It left its mark on the people that were involved in it. I don't think the Stones or the Grateful Dead or even the Jefferson Airplane were ever the same again.
Neither were the Hells Angels, who kind of already seen as a public enemy, certainly were looked down on even also, more after Altamont.
Also true. It was really the beginning of the end for the Hells Angels.
Joel, for all the darkness and violence and ugliness of that day, the Stones played really well, yeah?
I heard a 16-track mix done by Bob Matthews, who was the engineer for the Grateful Dead, recorded that day. And you wouldn't believe how good the Stones sound. Charlie Watts on drums, Bill Wyman on bass have everything locked down. And Mick Taylor and Keith Richards' guitars are just like gears turning together. And Jagger singing like he really means it. None of that kind of caricature vocals that he sometimes lapses into. Very committed, very convincing.
The Hells Angels ruined a great concert.
The fear that was coursing through those guys, the adrenaline, obviously played such a role, and they just went and buried themselves in the music. That's what musicians do.
Joel Selvin, his new book is Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. Joel, thanks for speaking with us.
Eric, my pleasure.
Sports fans are amped up for the Olympics, which officially start tomorrow. But there's a world of sports happening outside of Rio. Let's check in with Mike Pesca. He's Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Let's start with baseball. I mean, this week was the trade deadline, and there were some surprising deals, some players who did not get dealt. Tell us a little about the players that changed teams.
Jonathan Lucroy, who's an excellent catcher. He's great with the bat, and he also has a skill called framing, which doesn't mean that he'll help you install a painting in your home. But when you pitch, he makes the pitches look more like strikes than maybe they should be. It's a very subtle skill, but we're investigating it. Huh. He went from the Brewers to the Texas Rangers. That was a pretty big one. Jay Bruce, a powerful bat in the outfield, went from the Reds to the Mets. And the Dodgers got a pitcher named Rich Hill and a good position player named Josh Reddick from Oakland. So I don't know. Carlos Beltran went from the Yankees. And that was kind of significant, too, in a global sense, that the Yankees, for the first time in 15 years, were sellers. They said, this is not going to be our year, and the Yankees never say that.
Yeah, they kind of cleaned house a bit, Mike. I mean, giving up on a chance to make a run. It was only late July, early August. I mean, for diehard Yankee fans, it's probably pretty hard to take. Or was it?
Well, I would think that maybe they see more than a year in front of them, and they look at the haul they got, and they look at how baseball works now, which is you can't win every year, even if you are the Yankees. And so why not get some good prospects? So in a couple years, you'll be a great team rather than maybe a wild card team. Mm-hmm.
And any big names that didn't get traded, Mike?
Yeah, Chris Sale, who is not only a great pitcher, but a uniform critic. He actually took scissors to a bunch of uniforms he didn't like earlier this year.
Cut him
he
up.
Was not dealt by. Yeah, he was not dealt by the White Sox. His asking price was probably too high. And Yasiel Puig, a couple years ago, was talked about as the most exciting player in baseball, the most exciting young player. He's just had so many problems. He was actually demoted by the LA Dodgers and not traded.
Interesting. Let's switch to college football. I mean, it's not that far away. And the coaches poll came out today. Did Southern teams, as usual, dominate the rankings?
Well, yeah. Alabama, you know, they're a big Southern team. And Clemson. So we're talking about the national championship game participants last year. I hate these early season or preseason polls because even though the teams at the top usually are the teams that are great, past spot number 9, they're entirely unpredictive. And here's a crazy idea. Win a game before we rank you and tell you you're number one.
Right.
So I understand that it's expectation. But It has a, it would be one thing if it was just like, okay, here are some experts telling you what they think might happen. But this has real world impact. It sets sort of a standard, and teams that are even unfairly ranked high in the preseason polls have much more leeway than teams ranked low and wind up being better during the season. It would be more fair for football if they don't do anything until 4 weeks in and then come out with a poll.
Point well taken. Very briefly, in golf, Nike says it's going to stop making golf balls, bags, and clubs. What does this say about the state of golf?
That there's no Tiger Woods. And golf and Nike were equal Tiger Woods. And with him exiting the world stage, it just wasn't a big business for Nike. It was less than 10% of their business. They kind of need a superstar. They're a superstar-based business. And now that you have a lot of good, interesting golfers, Callaway and Adidas, which owns Top Flight, they're the companies that will be making the clubs, not Nike.
Mike Pesca hits the links. He's here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Four.
The Iraq War returned to the headlines this week because of Donald Trump's fight with the family of Humayun Khan, the Muslim American soldier killed in Iraq. The Trump campaign says people should blame Hillary Clinton more for Khan's death because she voted for the use of force against Iraq in 2002 when she was a newly elected senator from New York. Let's go back for some history with Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So a year and a month after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush's supporters in Congress introduced a bill that, among other things, said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was harboring members of the al-Qaeda terrorist group that was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. And I want to listen to some tape here. This is days before the Senate debate started. President Bush outlined his case against the Iraqi regime in a speech in Cincinnati, during which he claimed that Saddam Hussein had attempted to purchase aluminum tubes and other equipment to build nuclear weapons 11 years after promising to destroy his WMDs.
Some citizens wonder, after 11 years of living with this problem, why do we need to confront it now? And there's a reason. We've experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon. Knowing these realities, America must not ignore the threat gathering against us. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Now, at this point, Ron, we know that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction and certainly did not have a nuclear capability. But remind us of what the debate was like back then.
The debate was really quite balanced between those who thought that it was quite possible that Iraq did, but probably didn't have it yet, and those who were fear-mongering, essentially, and saying, but what if they do? And of course, we heard the famous line, we can't wait for a warning that comes in the shape of a mushroom cloud.
Right.
Those words really resonated and struck fear in, I think, particularly an older generation of Americans who remember the 1950s and 1960s when there was a great deal of fear of nuclear war. So that seems quaint to us now, but it suddenly seemed real in 2002 because the country was still reeling from the enormous shock of 9/11.
And Hillary Clinton was at the time a newly elected senator from New York, of course, the center of the 9/11 attacks, or one of the centers of the 9/11 attacks. And on October 10th, 2002, she spoke in favor of the resolution in Congress. Let's listen here to an extended clip.
Even though the resolution before the Senate is not as strong as I would like in requiring the diplomatic route first and placing highest priority on a simple, clear requirement for unlimited inspections, I will take the president at his word that he will try hard to pass a UN resolution and will seek to avoid war if at all possible. Because bipartisan support for this resolution makes success in the United Nations more likely, and therefore war less likely, and because a good faith effort by the United States, even if it fails, will bring more allies and legitimacy to our cause, I have concluded, after careful and serious consideration, that a vote for the resolution best serves the security of our nation. If we were to defeat this resolution or pass it with only a few Democrats, I am concerned that those who want to pretend this problem will go away with delay will oppose any UN resolution calling for unrestricted inspections. This is a very difficult vote. This is probably the hardest decision I've ever had to make. Any vote that might lead to war should be hard. But I cast it with conviction.
So Ron Elving, she had misgivings there. You can hear that. But she said this was a mistake, the vote that she took. Why did she vote for this resolution?
That was quite an array of reasons and a carefully parsed kind of justification for a vote she was clearly uncomfortable with, having to do, to a large degree, with pressuring the United Nations and the international community to get behind the United States and to line up against Saddam Hussein. But, of course, the risk she was taking was that the administration would use her vote and that of other Democrats as a kind of license to march into Iraq, as indeed they ultimately did. And, of course, she was relying on that same intelligence that apparently the administration was, which proved to be not just faulty, but quite wrong-headed about the capabilities of Saddam Hussein, the weapons of mass destruction that never materialized. And she imagined herself, and those around her, her advisors certainly imagined a situation in which she might be cast as some sort of latter-day McGovernite opposed to all forms of force, and that that would be an albatross for her politically. Of course, it turned out to be 180 degrees the opposite.
And there were a lot of other Democrats who did oppose the war and opposed this resolution. Let's listen to one of the most vocal, the late Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, who, when he spoke about it, recalled the vote to approve the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which let President Lyndon Johnson send troops to Vietnam without a formal declaration of war. Here's Robert Byrd.
Congress is again being asked to vote on the use of force without hard evidence that the country poses an immediate threat to the national security of the United States. We're being asked to vote on a resolution authorizing the use of force in a hyped up, politically charged atmosphere in an election year. Congress is again being rushed into a judgment. This is why I stand here today before this chamber and urge this nation, urge and pleading for some sanity.
And then on the other side, we had the former Navy Secretary and Virginia Republican Senator John Warner, who argued for the resolution, saying it was aimed at preventing war.
A strong bipartisan vote for this resolution is not an act of war. It is an act to deter war, to put in place the tools for our president, our Secretary of State, to get the strongest possible resolution in the United Nations. It is an act to see that force is the last, I repeat, the last option, as our president has said ever so clearly, time and time again.
Now, today, Ron, when people talk about this vote in favor of the Iraq war, it doesn't sound like they're saying it was a vote to deter war. It sounds like it was a vote for war. Was it really thought of at the time as a vote to deter war?
John Warner's argument here is a highly sophisticated one, and it may have been meaningful to some people. I suspect Hillary Clinton and other Democrats found it somewhat comforting. And so one has to say that it might have been, as John Warner described it, in some people's minds, a vote to deter war. But as we look back over the record, historians are indicating that it appears that the Bush administration was pretty set on invading Iraq pretty early on. Some people would even tell you that all of the talk of weapons of mass destruction had been a pretext for a predetermined policy. And if that's true, then John Warner was simply being led astray.
One more piece of tape I want to listen to, and that is the Republican nominee Donald Trump. This is him on September 11th, 2002. He was on the Howard Stern Show, and here he is.
We have an idea who the enemy is, and a lot of times the politicians don't want to tell you that.
Are you for invading Iraq?
Yeah, I guess. So, you know, I wish it was I wish the first time it was done correctly.
Now, today he says he's always been against it. Explain how his position has changed here, Ron.
Well, it seems that he was for it before he was against it, and that probably describes an enormous number of people. They thought perhaps we had to, maybe we should. And then, of course, as everything fell apart in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, people began to feel as though it had been a bad idea from the beginning. And, of course, and this is crucial, there were no weapons of mass destruction. And as a result, people felt they'd been ripped off. They felt they'd been lied to. And so a lot of people suddenly found it in themselves to say, you know, I was against this all along.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. And we'll link you to some of these videos of the speeches that were made at our website, hereandnow.org. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And an update now on a story we brought you yesterday. The Supreme Court has taken the side of Virginia schools in a battle over public bathrooms. The justices blocked a lower court's ruling that allowed a transgender student to use the boys' bathroom. The boy sued after the Virginia School Board required students to use the bathroom that matched the gender on their birth certificates. Justice Stephen Breyer joined four other conservative judges that voted in favor of the school board. Breyer said his vote was a courtesy to uphold the status quo while the court decides whether to hear the case. And it's likely the court will take up that issue. More than 20 states have challenged the Department of Education's order that allows students to use bathrooms, dorms, and locker rooms that match their gender identity. Well, the men and women who drive 18-wheeler trucks that crisscross our country are indispensable to the economy, but they spend long hours alone and they're constantly away from home. It can put a strain on the spirit. But in Southern California, there's a place that tries to help truckers by renewing their faith. Saul Gonzalez of KCRW reports from Los Angeles.
50 miles east of Los Angeles, just off Interstate 10, is one of the busiest long-haul truck stops in America. Here, tired drivers can park their big rigs for the night, grab a bite to eat, take a shower, and relax in front of a big-screen TV. And if the trucker's spirits feel a little road-weary, well, there's something for that here, too.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
In a converted trailer, the truck stop has its own chapel, one that's devoted to ministering to America's long-haul truckers.
You know, where else are these guys? They can't just pull up to a church. There's just no way. So we bring church to them.
Michael DeBay is the pastor at the Transport for Christ Chapel. It's part of a national nonprofit that operates nearly 40 truck stop chapels across the country.
We deal with people. I don't deal with trucks. I don't deal with tires. I don't deal with engines. I deal with the people inside that truck. I deal with the person that drives that truck.
And truckers, says Chaplain DeBay, face distinctive problems. Problems that might be difficult for them to explain to those who don't know about life on the road.
You know, you got to remember, they're spending most of their day by themselves with their own thoughts in their truck. They see more in a month than you and me will ever see in a year.
I imagine it could be lonely life.
Very lonely.
Driver Frank Palifax attends services in the truck stop chapel when he's driving through Southern California. He says his life as a trucker used to make him angry and depressed, especially during weeks-long absences from his wife in Phoenix. But Palifax says his religious faith has helped him cope.
I don't get upset anymore as much as I used to. I would get upset at truck stops, or I would get upset at deliveries or pickups, and that just says it's God's will, and I'm not going to get upset and get a heart attack, get a stroke. And so now I'm just calm and let it up to him.
During twice daily services in which about 40 people can fit in the trailer, Pastor DeBay preaches a conservative evangelical message. His God is stern but forgiving and constantly watches over drivers.
And we thank you, Jesus, for following the Father's orders and going all the way to the end. Even though you knew what was going to happen, you knew how you would suffer.
Pastor DeBay has been working at this truck stop for over 10 years. But because drivers are always on the move, he's never had a regular congregation. So before services, DeBay and his assistant Craig LeBlanc drive around the massive parking lot of the truck stop, coaxing drivers to attend sermons.
Brother, today's Resurrection Sunday. We want you to come to service. Okay, are you a Christian?
Yes, I am.
It's during these conversations and after services that DeBay says he often hears about problems in the trucking industry, including the pressures on drivers to meet tight schedules and log lots of miles. Many, he says, turn to substance abuse to cope.
Big time.
Drugs, alcohol, pills
to keep them going. Some of these drivers will come in and go, man, I haven't slept in 2 days. That's against the law. They have to every 10 hours take a break.
But they drive anyway.
And they drive anyway.
Because they got to make a schedule.
They got to make a schedule. If those wheels ain't rolling, they're not making any money.
After church services, driver Yancey Shipman walks out of the trailer. He's been on the road for 30 years and says the work can test body and soul.
It is a way of life. It rules your being. It used to be a joke, you know, you knew one thing certain about driving a truck. If you make plans, you ain't going to be there.
But whatever the trucker's problems on the open road, Pastor DeBay says he'll be ready to listen and fill them with spiritual fuel for their journey. For Here and Now, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Well, our web intern, Daniela Vidal, continues her journey now. She is heading back to the University of Missouri after spending the summer with us to continue her studies in journalism. Daniela, great work. Thank you, and best of luck to you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.